is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
You know, the scariest thing about Brian Koberger isn't what he did. It's what he planned to do next. Because before he even took that plea deal that spared him the death penalty, Koberger and his defense team were building a trial strategy that, if you can believe it, would have dragged the survivors, the friends, the ex-boyfriend of one of the victims onto the stand. For him. Not for justice. Not for closure. For him. Let that sink in for a second. Two women who lived through that nightmare in Moscow, Idaho, Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk, would have been forced to look the man who slaughtered their friends in the eye and answer his lawyer's questions. Because according to a newly unsealed filing, Brian Koberger planned to call them as defense witnesses. Yeah, that's how twisted this nearly became. When you look at the actual list, 138 people in total, you realize this wasn't going to be a simple reasonable doubt defense. This was going to be a siege, a psychological chess match. Mortensen, Funk, Emily Olden, Hunter Johnson, Jack DeCore, Kaylee Gonzalez's ex-boyfriend, names that belong to the very inner circle of the victims, the people whose trauma was already permanent. And Koberger, one of them under oath, called by him. Revictimize some more people. Why not? He's Brian Koberger. It's what he does. Now, the court filing doesn't spell out why. But if you read between the lines, if you know how defense strategy works in capital murder cases, it's pretty clear what they were aiming for. Humanization, confusion, and narrative control. Because the moment you drag survivors into the witness box and make them answer on your terms, you're not just building a defense, you're rewriting the story. And that was always Koberger's obsession, control of the narrative. And let's talk about what those testimonies might have looked like if the case had gone the distance. Dylan Mortensen, the roommate who woke to sounds that didn't make sense until it was far too late, would have been asked to describe the layout of the house, who locked the doors, who came and when, how often people visited. The goal wouldn't be truth, it would be doubt. Paint a picture of a chaotic student house full of comings and goings. An open door here, a noise there, a defense attorney's playground. Bethany Funk, whose written statement at sentencing admitted she couldn't even bear to enter the courtroom, would have faced a defense trying to chip away at her memory. Did you see the killer? No. Did you hear a name? No. Did you call 911? No. Every no meant another seed planted. Maybe she didn't really know what happened. Maybe nobody does. That's the game. That's what they would have played on the stand. And then there's the heartbreak of Emily Allant and Hunter Johnson, the first to arrive at the house after the murders. Johnson was the one who discovered the bodies. He was the one who told the surviving roommates to get out while he made sure no one was still inside and had to see everything firsthand, protecting his female friends from the horrors. Imagine reliving that on the stand. The defense would have turned the worst morning of his life into cross-examination fodder. Did you touch anything? Did you disturb the scene? Could someone have slipped out while you were there? All to try to make the evidence just a little less clean, a little less certain. So the jury's gut, not their reason, starts to wobble. And Jack DeCore, Kaylee's ex, the man who went from being the subject of Reddit rumors to the object of public sympathy, he'd have been asked to recount text, timing, heartbreak. Because to a defense lawyer, that's not grief. That's opportunity. Anything that shifts the lens, even an inch, This is the part where you realize just how ruthless trial strategy can be. When a defense has no real counter evidence, no DNA alternative, no other suspect, no credible alibi, they start poking holes in perception. They move the goalpost from did he do it to can you be absolutely sure? And they start using the people closest to the pain as their tools. It's brutal, but it's not uncommon. Calling survivors to the stand forces the jury to watch emotional chaos unfold right in front of them. Tears, guilt, fear, confusion, and hope. At least one juror sees uncertainty where there's really trauma. If this trial had gone forward, that's the circus we'd have been watching. Two young women forced to relive their terror under the banner of reasonable doubt. Friends grilled about the blood-soaked morning they found their classmates, and a man who once loved one of the victims questioned like a suspect in his own grief. That's not justice. That's theater. Now let's look at the flip side. What would the prosecution have done with that? Because, you know, they would have been ready. They take every emotional fracture the defense tried to exploit and weld it shut with forensic steel. They'd remind the jury of a knife sheath, the one found beside Madison Mogan's body with Koberger's DNA on the snap. They'd remind them of the phone pings that tracked his car looping that house in the dead of night, of the gloves, the cleaning supplies, the stalking patterns, the quiet obsession. And when the defense tried to use Dylan or Bethany to muddy the timeline, the prosecution would bring the focus right back. You were scared, weren't you? You thought he might come for you next. Yes. And just like that, the horror becomes evidence. Every tremble, every pause, every tear. Proof that this wasn't confusion. It was survival. Still imagine what it would have done to these people, testifying not against him, but for him, with no choice, being forced to sit 10 feet away from the man who butchered their friends and answering questions as if their answers could help him unintentionally. That's the part of the justice system most people never see or understand. The emotional toll of the witness list. A subpoena doesn't care about trauma. If your name's on it, you show up. And that's why when Koberger took his plea deal on July 2nd, 2025, one of the first people to speak up with relief was Stacy Chapin, Ethan Chapin's mother. She said there were so many kids, including our own, that had been subpoenaed that no longer have this hanging over their heads. We just all get to go on and live our life. That's the kind of mercy no verdict can buy. But think about what that says. Over 100 young people, friends, classmates, witnesses, were staring down the possibility of taking the stand. For months, they lived with that looming. That's not justice delayed. That's trauma on layaway. And then just like that, the plea deal wiped it away. No death penalty, no trial, no spectacle. For the families, it meant finality. For the survivors, it meant silence. Not the haunting kind, but the healing kind. And for Koberger, it meant the rest of his life behind bars, cut off from the platform he so clearly wanted. Because make no mistake here, this wasn't just about innocence or guilt. This was about control. The trial would have been his stage. He would have sat there every day watching the people he terrorized forced to say his name again and again. And he would have loved every second of it. That's what sociopaths do. They feed off the oxygen of attention. They turn other people's pain into their own currency. So yeah, when he finally stood up in that courtroom and admitted guilt, it wasn't redemption, it was surrender. Not to morality. To inevitability. But here's the haunting part of the alternate reality. If that trial had happened and Dylan Mortensen had taken that stand, imagine the sound of her voice under oath. That same voice that at sentencing cracked through the silence of the courtroom when she called him what he really is, a hollow vessel, something less than human, a body without empathy or remorse. Those words would have landed very differently coming from the defense's own witness list, wouldn't they? That is the irony. In trying to use her, he might have handed the prosecution their most powerful moment. Because there's nothing a jury remembers longer than a survivor naming evil to its face. And that's what the story really reveals. How the justice system doesn't just prosecute crimes, it weaponizes memory. Every witness, every name on a subpoena becomes a tool to shape what version of the truth survives. Koberger's defense didn't need Dylan Mortensen to prove he was innocent. They needed her to sound uncertain. They needed Bethany Funk to show fear, not confidence. They needed Jack DeCour to remind the jury that pain can look like guilt. They needed chaos because chaos is the last refuge of the guilty. But in the end, the evidence was too strong, the witnesses too scared, the risk too high. So the trial never came. And the list, that grotesque catalog of names, became just another artifact of the evil that almost was. And when you zoom out, that's the pattern of predators like Koberger. Control until the end. They all do it. Even from behind bars. Even when the world is calling them monsters, they still try to script the scene. But for once, he didn't get to. The survivors didn't have to take the stand. The families didn't have to hear their children's names twisted into cross-examination strategy. And the courtroom didn't become another theater for his ego. Because the justice system, imperfect as it is, sometimes gets the ending right. Not perfect, but just right enough. So when they hear that Brian Koberger had planned to call the friends, the very people he murdered, to testify for him, remember, that's not just audacity, that's pathology. That's the hollow vessel Dylan Mortensen was talking about. He didn't just want to end their lives. He wanted to own the story that came after. And that's why, even in silence, his conviction matters. Because the one thing he'll never control again is the narrative. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That is where you will find us. Search it where we get podcasts, too. Take us on the go. We're not just on YouTube. We're not just on the podcast platforms. We're everywhere you want to be. Just like Visa in the 90s. Remember those ads? Everywhere you want to be. Join us, though. Please hit subscribe on both platforms and you can take us along. We do appreciate that. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again, really.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.